Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, and KBDH, San Ardo. Learn more about HD radio at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Donald Spoto is my guest this week. He's the author of some 22 books, one of which, his classic, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, has been on my bookshelf for over 30 years and is a valuable asset to the understanding of Hitchcock's work. Donald Spoto has written many biographies of creative and notable people, including Laurence Olivier, Ingrid Bergman, James Dean, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Tennessee Williams. This summer, I read Enchantment, The Life of Audrey Hepburn. Joining us tonight from Denmark, Donald Spoto. Welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Before we talk about Audrey Hepburn, I'd like to discuss some of the body of your work, and I'd like to begin with my favorite, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock. This was your first work on Hitchcock. I think you've done two. And the director was still alive, although he had completed his last film when it was published. It's a book that takes a painstaking look at the director's work and the symbolism that runs through his films. Did Hitchcock ever see the book, do you know?
Oh, yes, he did indeed. In fact, I was extremely gratified when he volunteered to make a tape in the fall of 1976 endorsing the book, and he gave a luncheon for the celebration of it, for the publication of it, and brought me out to Los Angeles. I was living in New York at the time. And he was thrilled with the book, and we became good friends the last 5 years of his life. So it was a great honor to have my first book so heartily endorsed by him. And, of course, my great friend Grace Kelly, Grace of Monaco, offered to write the foreword to that book after we had met. So it was really kind of a blessed project from day one.
And what a fantastic book it is. I think your analysis of Topaz is more interesting than Topaz, possibly. How did you draw your insights, and if you don't mind going all the way back 31 years to that book, or 32 years, I guess it's been now, how did you go about it in the pre-video era of watching the films? What kind of process did you have to go through?
Well, it was really a wonderful, wonderful time. I was teaching at the time. I taught one of the first courses in Hitchcock at a university in New York City, and of course, all the films were then available on 16mm, and as I showed them to the students and looked at them again and again and again, and then, of course, when Hitchcock was honored in 1974 at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, the retrospective cinema houses in New York started to show all his old films. So I was able to see all of them many times. You're quite right, it was the pre-video era. And then I made my way over to England to the offices of the British Film Institute, where I was able to see his silent pictures, which are stored in their vaults. Now, of course, everything is available, so that when I wrote a revised edition to that book in 1999 for the Hitchcock centenary, I was able to have another look at some of my chapters and polish and add some things. And I'm happy to say that as you say, after 31, 32 years, the book is still in print and I think provides some interesting food for thought for film students and for the general public.
How do you decide on whom to write? I mean, is there a logical progression? I know that you wrote another book about Hitchcock that was more of a biography. And
yes,
then
I did. After he died, I undertook to write his biography. And that, too, is still in print. The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, was published in 1983. So that's 24 years old, almost 25 years old. And it was a great honor to do that book because I felt that Hitchcock was one of the major artists of the 20th century and a hugely successful entertainer and deserved a serious biography. So to address your question of how do I decide, there's no logical progression because one sort of can't see the future, but I have to be gripped by a person's artistic achievement or by their life, by their achievements in life. I have to find something profoundly attractive and admirable in their work or their life or both in order to spend the time and the effort and whatever talent I have to describing and exploring the contours of their life. Certainly, since teenage years, I admired Hitchcock's films. I was a high school boy when his great masterworks were first screened in America. Similarly with Tennessee Williams, I was deeply struck by his plays when I was very young, and had an appointment with him, actually, to talk about some kind of book about his life's work when he died rather suddenly. And so I undertook his biography with great enthusiasm from the publisher. The others, you know, I got to know, for example, during my Hitchcock years, I got to know Ingrid Bergman quite well in the last 8 years of her life. That was a great honor. And when she died, I undertook her biography with wonderful cooperation from family and friends. And others, I felt, also were people who deserved serious biography, not fiction and not gossip. And that's what I've tried to do in my career, and it's what I'm trying to do now in the books that are on the burner, so to speak.
Well, so in other words, you don't think you could write a book about, say, Mussolini or somebody that you don't feel a certain respect or admiration for?
Well, I think that's it exactly, Gary. And in addition to that, I have, you know, certain gifts and abilities, and my field is the creative life, the performing arts. Someone said to me the other day, why don't you do a life of Muhammad Ali, the boxer? And I said, that doesn't remotely interest me, not because I think he's not probably a very interesting figure in sports history, but I don't write about sports or science or politics.
But you have done quite a few biographies of theological personalities.
Yes. Well, that's my field, actually. I was trained as a theologian. I took a doctorate degree in theology, and you know, so I was delighted to turn to a life of St. Francis of Assisi and a life of Joan of Arc and a book of meditations on Jesus of Nazareth and to do a book on the history of prayer from the viewpoint of all faiths and all traditions. That was very important for me to do. So, you know, people say, oh, well, but you write about movie and theater people, how can you write about theology? Well, like most people, I have more than one interest.
know? That's
However,
incredible.
That said, politics and sports and science is really outside the circle for me.
Yes, well, I can understand that. Do you feel your being as a theologian as well as a historian of cinema, do you think that influences your work? Like in the Audrey Hepburn book, you love the nun story above all of her other films. You have quite a bit about Joan of Arc in the Ingrid Bergman book. I'm just, what do you think? Is there a possibility?
Well, two answers to that, Gary. First of all, I suppose it's up to my readers to decide what influence there is on that.
Yeah.
You know, I try not to be self-conscious about it.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I think one can make a very good case that the nun story is Audrey's greatest performance, her greatest film, her profoundest achievement. She won the British Oscar for it, British Academy Award, and was nominated in America for it. She considered it her most important film. And it affected and influenced her own life and thinking more than any other film that she made. So I think one could make a case that that is a significant work, quite apart from the appeal that it may have for me. You know, I mean, and I think similarly in the case of Ingrid. When I knew Ingrid, we had many discussions about her own love for and attraction to the story of Joan of Arc. She felt that way since her youth. So in her lifetime, she appeared in a film, a play, and an oratorio about Joan of Arc. So one has to take Joan very seriously in discussing the life of Ingrid. And then, of course, I did last year, very early this year, HarperCollins published my new biography of Joan of Arc, and I had access to some wonderful new archival material that has come to light. So, your question about how, you know, a theologian's background influences me, I can't say. I suppose my readers have to say. In one area, however, I hope there is an influence, and that is I hope that it has prevented me from being a judgmental biographer. I hope it has in some way deepened my compassion for people and the extraordinary suffering that people endure. But that's not a theological so much as a human issue. So, you know, I leave it there.
But we're speaking with Donald Spoto, who is a biographer of many great creative personalities over the years. Well, let me just follow up on that, if you don't mind. Do you think that your work is totally objective? Because I know that you never shy away from critiquing the films of your subjects.
Well, I think that, first of all, total objectivity never exists. It doesn't exist in writing history, writing documentary, writing biography, which is a form of history. Total objectivity never exists because the past is gone. And we can never recapture every contour and every texture and every fiber of it. All the biographer and the historian can hope to do is to offer a take on a human life. And, for example, in the area of biography. And that does not mean prettifying or glorifying or glamorizing. It's one thing to show that in all life, in my life, in your life, in the life of every one of our listeners, there are times and moments when we are unhelpful to ourselves, when we make mistakes. It's not up to the biographer to pass judgment. It is up to the biographer to assess how a person balances life and work, how they are faithful to their ideas and ideals. That is not passing judgment. That is not being a judge and a jury. That is trying as much as one can to show both the suffering and the achievement and the happiness in life. And I've tried to be faithful to that program.
So when you wrote of Ingrid Bergman's sort of unkind first marriage, or Audrey Hepburn's rather unwise two marriages, I guess there are. Is it difficult to, because you do have the cooperation to a certain extent of her friends and family. Is that difficult?
It's not difficult. I mean, it's strange, Gary. I think my experience has been that it's more difficult for readers in America and Britain to accept the fact that I'm writing about human beings, not angels and not demons, but human beings. We're all of us playing, shall we say, with an incomplete deck. We're all of us under the influence of our childhood and our background and our parents' childhoods and backgrounds. So to demonstrate the sine curve of life, to put it cheaply, the ups and downs, is not to say anything negative, is to describe a human life. And I think that often it's difficult for Americans to accept that their idols are not idols. In Europe, it's very interesting. The reaction is very different. People do not expect film stars, European readers do not expect film stars to be stained glass window saints. I think we do a huge disservice to people like Ingrid and Hitchcock and Audrey if we paint them in unrealistic colors, because if we do that, we erase all of the suffering and all the struggle out of their lives. And I think to do that is a huge disservice to people.
Well, Enchantment, the life of Audrey Hepburn, really brings the star to life for the reader on the page. What drew you to come to write of her?
Well, I appreciate that question very much. I had the pleasure of meeting Audrey Hepburn. I can't say I knew her very well, and we were great friends, but I did meet her and get to know her briefly. I also felt, a few years ago, that what had been written about Audrey was woefully insufficient. I read all the books. I read the articles. And on the one hand, she had been turned into this unrealistic figure, and she hated that, as Ingrid did during her lifetime. And on the other hand, terrible things were made up about her. So I began to explore by talking to people who knew her very well, who worked with her over the span of years, and a very different picture emerged. I had the same experience when I undertook the life of Marilyn Monroe over 15 years ago. A very different picture emerged from the received tradition about Marilyn Monroe. So I felt Audrey deserves better, and I will try to do better by her.
Well, she seems to be the most genuinely modest of all the subjects you've written about, although Ingrid Bergman tried to hand her Oscar to another actress when she won for Murder on the Orient Express. But was Audrey Hepburn truly as modest as she...
She was. She was a remarkably sympathetic woman. She was... what is the cliche people use today? She was a real person, you know. I guess that means she wasn't a real cabbage. She was a real person. But she was. She was in touch with the suffering and struggle of her own childhood. Her father walked out on her and her mother when she was a child. She experienced the Nazi invasion of Holland when she almost starved to death as a child. She struggled in London to be a ballet dancer, a dream that was shattered. She almost stumbled by accident into movies, had a wonderful, wonderful career. But the great joy and the great achievement of her life, she considered the last 6 years when she went around the world raising money and dealing personally with the starving children of the world on behalf of UNICEF. She saw that as the true depth of her life. And I think she deserves very high marks for this. She could have just been, you know, this glamorous person who went to banquets and wore great-looking clothes and raised money. And who would have done anything except thank her for that? But for Audrey, this was not enough. She was touched by the plight of the starving children of the world, and she went into the most dangerous parts of the world to raise awareness. And, you know, that's a very, very moving part of the book. So, you know, I think we have to admire her for that. It's not the story of St. Audrey. She would have cringed. She did cringe when she was treated, as I say, as if she were a stained glass window figure. She hated that because it wasn't true. She was a human being. And I think the more people understand, for example, the heartache that she endured in some romantic affairs that she had, the more people understand this, the more sympathetic a person she becomes.
We're speaking with Donald Spoto about his new book about Audrey Hepburn called Enchantment, The Life of Audrey Hepburn. There's a lovely story in the book, speaking of her modesty, that I wonder if you'd share about the TV film that she was working with Robert Wagner. Do you know what I'm asking about?
Oh, yes! That's a marvelous, you know... moment. Audrey was, as you say, doing a television film late in her career with Robert Wagner, that fine actor and gentleman, and she was very nervous because he had so much more experience, not only with the number of films, but a number of TV movies, which are made very quickly, you know, and very expeditiously. So she was quite nervous, and she went to the director and said, "Listen," she said, "I'm so nervous. I'm really relying on you." And she went to the director and said, "I'm just so nervous. You've got to tell Robert Wagner to help me because I'm so nervous appearing with him." At the same time, Wagner was going to the director and saying, "I'm so nervous appearing opposite the great Audrey Hepburn. You know, what shall I do?" And they found out about this, had a good laugh over it, and turned in lovely performances in a perfectly terrible project.
It does seem like her, sort of the autumn of her career, where she came back from her retirement. She maybe should have stayed retired, as she sort of retired at a perfect point in her career. Maybe didn't do quite as good work in the second part.
Well, the problem is that the era of the Audrey Hepburn type or style had passed by really after she made Wait Until Dark in 1966. The style of films changed. Instead of the elegance and understatement of Audrey and her style, We had The Graduate and The Dirty Dozen, and we had Bonnie and Clyde. The style of movies and their expectations of the public changed radically, and Audrey was not about to go into films and use four-letter words and, you know, dress in a dress down. I mean, she wanted to be herself and find roles that were appropriate, and they dried up.
She was more of the old Hollywood style of movie star then.
Well, she did, you know, and also she wasn't old enough, you see. That's the thing. For character roles, I can remember when I first got to know Ingrid Bergman, she was in her 50s, and she said, I'm at that awkward age. I'm too old to play a romantic leading lady, and I'm too young to play eccentric grandmothers and character roles, so I hope that maybe some of these will come along. Well, she did. She did, as you mentioned, Murder on the Orient Express and The Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil Frankweiler, and she did a brilliant turn in Ingmar Bergman's Autumn Sonata. But that's because Ingrid survived into her 60s. Audrey did too, but she was keen enough to know what was her range and what was being offered to her. And then, of course, as I say, along came UNICEF, and that reduced to a cinder, in her eyes, any desire to maintain herself as a movie star.
When she was a movie star, she was constantly paired with older actors, Humphrey Bogart and Cary Grant and Gary Cooper, Gary Cooper must have been older than her father. How did she feel about being paired with these older men?
Well, first of all, she was delighted to appear opposite, as you say, Humphrey Bogart, Fred Astaire, Gary Cooper, and the rest. But watching these films today, Gary, is faintly distasteful. And these films could not be made with this age difference today. They were old enough to be her father, and more. Astaire, for example, in that really delightful musical comedy Funny Face, Astaire was 30 years her senior. And when they go dancing off into the sunset at the end of that picture, audiences in 1956 were enchanted by it. But today, when people watch it, we get a vaguely sinister distaste for this. And of course, Bogart especially. What makes Sabrina very difficult to watch is that it's almost impossible for us to accept that Audrey Hepburn would give up William Holden for Humphrey Bogart. I mean, that just taxes credibility today. How did audiences feel about it in 1954? Probably we were so used to movies being fairy tales that it was ignored, but some of the critics did take note of this. Now, why were these much older men paired with her? Gary Cooper, for example, in Billy Wilder's Love in the Afternoon, they had to use filters and put him in shadow because he looked so much older and so dreadful. But why did they do this? Because Audrey was never a sex symbol. There was something unreal about her that movies wanted to capitalize on. She was never a sensual star. She refused to have her figure padded. There was something ethereal about her. And the movies capitalized on this. So in a sense, her romantic films, her romantic comedies, there was something asexual about them. Hence the older players. I mean, we never had the impression of any passion being exchanged between her and Fred Astaire in Funny Face. Of course, Fred Astaire was never a passionate leading man in any case. He was a brilliant talent, a brilliant dancer, a charming performer.
The passion,
but never
the passion expressed through the dance, I would assume, I guess.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And it was elegant and fun. But you see, Audrey was never presented as a sex symbol. Never.
But she was always a very glamorous figure, and her wardrobe, of course, a sensation. How do you think she'd feel about being used to shill trousers for The Gap?
I think the only situation, condition under which she would approve of that, Gary, would be if the money were given to UNICEF. Otherwise, just as a commercial venture, I think it would infuriate her. Because, you know, I mean, she wore jeans mostly in private life. It's not the jeans She wasn't so stuffy and arrogant. It was, you know, the use of her image. And she was very, very careful about that. That's, for example, why she refused to honor her contract and appear in a Hitchcock film when she read the finished script. Yes, she got pregnant also, conveniently, but she wouldn't do it because there was a violent rape strangulation in it, attempted rape strangulation, and she wouldn't do a scene like that. She had just filmed The Nun Story. She was very protective of her image, and she didn't like violence in pictures. She saw the writing on the wall for the future of popular movies and didn't want to contribute to it.
Breakfast at Tiffany's, one of Audrey Hepburn's most famous films. What are your thoughts on Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Well, to tell you the truth, and I hope our listeners don't become very cross and angry with me, it's not my favorite Audrey film. First of all, it is incredible that to believe that Audrey Hepburn in this picture is a high-class call girl. We just don't believe it. Quite apart from that, it's a very messy and, I think, distasteful picture. It's given its charm by Audrey and by the chemistry she had in her scenes with George, with the late George Peppard. And Blake Edwards did his very best. And we remember the love scene in the rain at the end, and, of course, Moon River, when she sits on the fire escape and accompanies herself on the guitar singing Moon River. It became Audrey's signature tune, and it's irresistible. It's terribly, terribly touching. Audrey Hepburn is a high-class call girl in New York, who comes from a hillbilly family. This is taxing credibility in a way far more, for example, than that we believe when she's Sister Luke in The Nun Story, because there is something so ingenuous, so serious, so grave, so dear, so whole and integrated about her in that performance. So it's not one of my favorite pictures, but of course A Little Black Dress entered the international iconography, and if it draws people to consider the value of Audrey Hepburn for all time, if it draws people to have another look at her remarkable life and achievement, then fine.
We're after the same rainbows and the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River and me.
Donald Spoto is my guest. The book is called Enchantment, The Life of Audrey Hepburn. And Mr. Spoto, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening.
It's absolutely a pleasure, and I send good wishes to all listeners and friends in Northern California.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. I'll be back again next week with another great program. Until then, you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro.